excited to have Brian Chow on the podcast today. And could you start sort of giving a brief background just for the audience so they know your skill set and sort of what the conversation might be about?
Right. It's very weird because my background is kind of in mathematics, theoretical computer science. And then it was like a machine learning engineer, like nothing like research level, just like very, very applied. Very industry level for a bit. And then at the same time, I started writing on mostly politics and kind of political psychology. And this got a lot of traction as well. I started a podcast, and that's what most people online know me for. And now I've kind of recapitulated my past and am going to work in basically machine learning policy, essentially trying to make sure that you don't have kind of destructive bans on AI. So that is the short version of the story. I can expand on any part of it if you'd like.
I'm curious how you got into the Emerging Ventures Fellowship, or like, was the grant for your podcast or for more so for the policy research?
Yeah, so it was purely for writing and podcasting. At that point, I did not pay too much attention. Like, here's the funny thing, is that for like almost all of my life, it was basically like two streams, right? I was doing on one hand, like technical, basically like either math, computer science, machine learning stuff. And I just sort of grouped this into one bucket, and then like machine learning was in the first bucket. And then like all of the political online, you know, like Twitter posting and writing stuff. I very rarely talked about technical things. That was not really, I was writing mostly as a kind of escape from that. But of course, you know, relevance strikes, opportunity calls, you know, duty calls. When, you know, suddenly all these people are posting about AI and really very few of them know much at all about AI, any of the technical details, then that became kind of something that I needed to write more about.
Yeah. How did you get into writing on like podcasting initially?
You said it's like an escape. Completely by random. Like I literally started an anonymous Twitter account and started posting.
Cactus something?
Yeah, yeah. And then I don't remember. I got early traction in a bunch of places. Benjamin Boyce, shout out to him. Who was the second podcast I went on? Richard Hanania linked to me on his Substack very early on. A bunch of people retweeted me, but I honestly don't even remember. But yeah, it was just completely anonymous. Didn't have any kind of like, when I was first starting, I basically knew no one in the kind of political or media world at all. And yeah, it's just a long climb up.
Right. Do you think about the practice of writing at all? Sort of like polishing your writing or becoming a better writer, or is this more so a tool to bring out your ideas?
Yeah, I think about it a lot in that I think I'm still bad at it. It's more of kind of identifying what not to do, because naturally I think the way I think and the way I go through ideas is much more suited to math or suited to even just like writing software. It's not very well suited for writing. And I think like the biggest distinction is like writing, you really, there's a very high premium on linearity, right? There's a very high premium on like only doing like one thing, and essentially having a straight stream of information that is sequential. And to me, this is like a very poor way of thinking. Not that I look down on people who think like that, but like, which is most people, but it feels very unnatural to me, right? So to write, I kind of have to force my really kind of like very parallel, only somewhat related kind of like disconnected thought into like just one thing that I'm doing, right? And that, yeah, to do that like properly is a very strange thing for me that I'm still learning about, that I definitely pay a lot of attention to improving. But I don't think I'm a particularly good writer. Like I'm not sure how much any of that advice, like I feel like for most people that's just like obvious, right? And they don't even have to think about it. That's just what they do.
Yeah, I think you're the point you made about it being sort of linearly, and I guess what one issue or focusing on one issue and having a sort of a linear sequence of additional thoughts makes sense. Where even in school, I think they would rather teach you to have like this exposition of arguments and then pros and cons and then introduce each of them. So it's definitely hard to learn the skill, I'd say.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And yeah, how do you think about
the question that's kind of up in the air is like, why would I do this in the first place then? But yeah, I do think it's mostly about the ideas. I do think like part of what got traction and what kind of, I think like to this day, I still have a very high ratio of kind of like second degree followers to followers on Twitter. And that's, you know, that's obviously kind of a rough metric for the actual thing I care about, which is something like kind of elite influence, right? I do think there are a lot more people who follow me kind of for the content rather than the presentation. I think like when it comes to idea curation, I think that's, I'm not sure if you were there when I talked about this. It was in the room with Richard Hanania and Shri Meshowitz at Emergent Ventures. But I think like the thing that, if there is anything in terms of content that I have kind of very strong asymmetry on, it's just like noticing what technical ideas are important for kind of like societal consequences, right? Really drawing a line between the two. I think that's the big value generator from the new world, for the podcast and for the newsletter.
Right. Yeah. And I think even the sort of software engineering like writing styles rhymes well with like connecting the two domains. So I like reading your writing.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe to go to the next point of a topic here with these connected topics of technology and influence society. And some people are like very worried that we'll have like 50% chance that it will wipe out humanity. And I think there's even a much bigger group who's like less pessimistic, but still thinks it's like a dangerous technology that we need to regulate. Yeah, the best argument I've seen so far is that so and so many percentage of the actual machine learning researchers are saying that it's dangerous. And I still don't fully understand why the very technically able people that actually understand how machine learning works are claiming that it's like a dangerous technology and so on. So I'm curious if you understand why.
So personally, I'm kind of skeptical on the kind of doom thing. I think we should be a little bit more specific when we talk about danger, because there's kind of two interpretations of this. One is the really like genuinely apocalyptic, you know, like Eliza Yudkowsky, AI will take over the world and kill everybody. Right. That's one side of it. One side of it is just like AI will be used by hackers, which is true. Like AI will be used by hackers. It will be used by almost everyone. It would be very surprising if hackers were just the one type of people who decided not to use it. But yeah, those are more kind of like human, like near term, just really like normal concerns. And I think those, you know, are dealt with basically in the same way you deal with concerns over any type of technology, you know, like what about getting people on the internet? Will that allow more hackers access to things? Of course it will, right? Is there some kind of upside aside from that? Of course there is, right? As there is in machine learning, makes life much easier, is essentially a better use kind of like auto, or like not even like just autocomplete, right? But really something that allows you to extend your range of composition a lot more. I think that in general, that those kinds, the kinds of concerns that are like, you know, hackers will use AI, they're reasonable in terms of they're probably fairly likely to happen. And they're small in magnitude in that the benefit from AI just outweighs those types of concerns. Dealing with the second bucket is like the apocalyptic concerns, right? AI will kill everyone. So I think like dependent on this, or like a necessary prerequisite of this, is that essentially you just get like ever accelerating progress. Things are just so fast. Look at how remarkable the machine learning research community is. And then they have this idea that eventually AI becomes so competent that you'll be able to use AI to improve AI. And this will just keep going until it's kind of like unimaginably more competent. And at that point, taking over the world will be basically trivial. So there are like a few assumptions, I think, that make this maybe a little bit more reasonable than it might sound to the average person, which is basically kind of, oh, the value of compounding returns. This is very well known in technology. And the second is kind of like, So I'm trying to steel man. I'm trying to steel man their case. Mm. The most reasonable way that I would say it is kind of like, it is sort of like a slippery slope or like a snowball thing, right? Where basically once you have something that's kind of like slightly smarter, you don't is still capable of improvement, you don't expect that gap to get smaller, right? They kind of expect that gap to like just keep going and going and going up indefinitely. So you don't get, you know, you don't get to the level where AI is maybe, you know, like smarter than 90% of humans, but it doesn't get smarter than that. Like they're very skeptical that will happen. And I'm just going to pose that as an assumption that they make, because I think their arguments for why that's the case are actually very poor. But if you assume those two things, right, if you assume that, you know, like basically that you'll keep on getting a very high rate of improvement continuously, and that once you reach kind of like better than human level, then it'll keep going to infinity, then like this becomes a slightly more reasonable belief, I think.
Yeah, I think the main argument they use as evidence there is just the scaling laws, which I think in theory sort of go into that direction if we assume we can like just scale up the model infinitely. But even then, I think the assumption that this will lead to AGI is kind of wrong, because there will not be sort of an agentness that, or sort of a disobedience where the AI can decide like, oh, I'll just ignore this and like go my own way, or this is just not the capability of these kinds of models.
I think like, I don't know, especially when it comes to the really far off kind of like game theory of like, okay, what happens if an AI like wants to accomplish certain goals and it's not aligned. Like if you're discussing about that, I think that you're already off in an unproductive discussion. Like, to me, the technical constraints on developing superhuman AI are the core thing here, right? Like,
right.
No matter what your kind of argument on hypotheticals is, you know, like, hypothetically, if we got, you know, a superhuman AGI, what would happen? You're still arguing, no matter what you're doing, you're still basically arguing over hypotheticals. There's no kind of grounding in reality for kind of arguing over those things. And so your variance is going to be so high that you're never really going to convince anyone for sure about these things. Whereas for the technical questions, I think those are much more grounded, and those things are at least things that we can begin to answer using the information we have right now.
Would you say there's a third bucket of the job displacement doomers, and that they fear that it will like disrupt society? Or is it sort of the same bucket as the hacker, like malus AI stuff?
Yeah, obviously you can kind of keep subdividing, right? You can keep going into more detailed categories. Yeah, I think in my head I immediately associate those with the kind of worries about hackers. Yeah, I think that, I don't know, I actually have a very interesting conversation with Curtis Yarvin coming up where we kind of discuss the implications of this, right? Like I think like among normal people, the risk of automation is extremely overrated, but among economists, the risk is underrated, right? So the first layer of it is like the super naive argument is something like, all right, the machine learning algorithms are going to displace these people. They're just going to do the job better and cheaper. And then those people are just going to be like out of a job permanently, and they're all going to starve to death if we don't give them GPI. The second layer is economists view, or like the default economist view of you get equivalent exchange. These people will find something better to do. They're also skeptical that, you know, they expect some level of AGI but they assume some level of kind of artificial specific intelligence, right? That basically can automate, you know, let's say like 30 to 40% of people. And then those people, you know, because it can only do the AI can only do a finite number of things, there's a very large category of things that the AI cannot do, basically. Those people can just find employment in those areas. So that's like the second layer view. I think it's definitely much more true than the kind of first layer view. And then the third layer view, which I discussed with Curtis, I think Curtis has like a more extreme version of this, far more extreme version of this than me. But like the third layer of things is basically looking at this displacement effect as like Goodhart's law. Right. Like, if you just look at the American economy, there's certainly like a much higher, especially like the service economy. Right. There's a lot higher prevalence of basically, you know, like the term bullshit jobs by David Graeber. You have a lot of inflation of bureaucracy. You have a lot of inflation of essentially middle management that isn't actually accomplished anything. You have a lot of these intermediate positions that are essentially signaling, even like what is the business model of Starbucks, right, as opposed to like, I don't know, McDonald's, right? Why does Starbucks charge like three times more for a coffee than McDonald's? A lot of it is kind of signaling, and a lot of it is basically producing these, you know, like quote unquote luxury goods, but they're not luxury goods because they're actually luxuries. It's not like your Corvette, where you would actually rather drive the Corvette, right? It's this kind of like purely signaling good. I mean, like, I'm sure a lot of people only drive Corvettes because of the signaling, but like hypothetically, you know, it's a better car as well, right? I'm not sure how much of a distinction this is, but essentially that like the more additional resources that you have, the more percentage of humanity is basically like the best thing that they can do is basically non-productive or kind of manipulative in some way, and basically a job that only exists because you can like abuse problems in psychology and abuse problems in judgment by like either governments, by large corporations, or by, you know, someone else.
So what was the effect called, or Goodhart's law, or some law?
Yeah, Goodhart's law. It's basically the idea is that any it's not really kind of like a hard and fast law, but it's a general pattern that if you set something, if you set an approximate for something as the goal, then that becomes a much worse approximate, right? So for example, if you set like test scores as a goal for like school funding, right, then teachers suddenly begin giving much easier test scores, right, or much higher test scores, because they're incentivized to do so. So the correspondence to like how good a school actually is, that decreases.
And what was the connection to comparing this with the English, like the average human overrates the misplacement and the economist underrates?
Yeah, the idea is that the more that you're essentially applying Goodhart's law to like unemployment, right? That the more people are kind of worried about unemployment, and the more, you know, in this view, the higher fraction of people, like I'm sure that like even today there are some fraction of people who are just completely unemployable, right? The higher that fraction becomes, the higher of a fraction of basically like the useful essential work is being done by artificial intelligence, the more human labor essentially goes into finding areas of the economy or finding areas of essentially like human psychology that you can exploit that don't actually do anything productive.
Interesting. I don't fully see the causal chain here. So you're saying, or Yarvin is saying,
right. So you have two buckets of things, right? Things that are actually useful and things that are not useful. And in each bucket, like you can try to do something that like essentially that like makes money, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then the more opportunities in the first bucket are kind of taken up by AI, you know, at least, and of course, you know, it's not completely zero sum. There'll be new opportunities created, right? So on and so forth, right? But the idea is that you can have a shift in order into the second bucket of essentially de facto subsidizing like bullshit jobs. I'm not sure how large of the effect this will be. Curtis is very concerned about it. I think it will exist to some degree, right? Like the number of bullshit jobs might go up by like, I don't know, 10%, right? That's a very rough estimate. But like basically that's around the order of magnitude that I think it is, right? I don't think it's going to be, you know, like we're suddenly going to have everyone doing things that are completely useless. I think that's very unlikely.
Yeah, and we even disagree a bit with the premise that there's like bullshit jobs and like signaling based jobs and non like sort of like delivering actual value, where I think for the end user, it's the same. It's just like a value generation. So if I preferred a Starbucks coffee, it is not only because I was like manipulated in preferring it, but because it's the obvious brand choice. I have convenience in deciding on like which coffee place I choose. And I have this familiar environment that is like very much pleasing to me because the barista smiles at me. I know what's got to experience. So I already find it difficult to assume that there's like these two types of jobs or products.
Yeah. Like, there is one version of this. I think that's a valid critique to raise in some aspect, right? I think that, like, people can certainly overestimate, you know, like, they can overestimate what people's, like, real beliefs are, right? You can kind of project that, like, everyone is, you know, kind of rational, and the only things that they would want are in their self-interest, and they would never be willing to pay for essentially social contact. And if they are willing to pay for, and like your argument would be that if they are willing to essentially pay for social contact and signaling and aesthetics, then, you know, that's their choice. They should be basically allowed to do that. I think like that's not really a disagreement in terms of like what will happen, right? That's just a disagreement on like, is that actually bad? I don't know. I think if people are kind of doing more signaling, then that's a bad thing. But like, if your perspective is just that, you know, that's a part of life, some people genuinely want that, and that's just going to be like fine for them, then like, sure, then like you should be worried about this less.
Cool. And then the economists underrate the misplacement because they assume sort of this extremely rational equivalence in skill sets and abilities. And
I think they just ignore that kind of like basically subsidy for signaling, right? Which maybe you don't think is a bad thing, but I think many economists do think it's a bad thing, and they still underrate its significance, right? People are kind of over optimistic on essentially the productivity gains because they assume that all of the displaced people will be doing something useful and instead of doing something that could be kind of like actively bad for society.
Okay. Interesting. Why would the expansion in like opportunities shift thoughts more signaling related or like sort of fake value creation rather than sort of if you assume like non-zero job opportunities in the world because people have more problems, new problems are created? Is the argument that by nature these new problems are more related to like sort of fake value creation or like signaling based stuff?
Yeah. So like if you just take a look at the best example of this is with kind of like current history, especially with kind of like with automation and offshoring of labor jobs, is, you know, like the thing that is addressed by essentially like a textile factory or a farm is just much more, like, at the very least, is not kind of like net negative. Where you could argue that, like, the thing that's happening with, like, you know, basically most HR departments is, like, literally net negative for society, right? Like, it's very hard to, like, this is much more of a cost in terms of, like, it's not really a cost in terms of the economic cost, because the thing that's being displaced is the thing that is, like, higher in value, or, like, is the thing that's, like, creating the productivity cost, right? Like, the positive side is all in, like, the fact that people don't have to do, like, so if you look at, like, two sides of the balance sheet, right, your positives are basically that, like, jobs are automated, that you no longer have to have as many people working in farms or factories or so on and so forth. And then, like, your negative cost is actually the thing that, like, people are up to now, right? And to the extent that, like, this is a cost, I don't think it outweighs the baseline problems of AI. I don't think it outweighs, like, the benefits of AI, sorry. But it's just, like, it's just something that's underrated. Like, I don't think it's so significant that, you know, it's going to cause a huge problem. But it's just, like, it's just a thing that's underrated in terms of, like, oh, here is maybe, like, the third term you should be computing if you're going to forecast the economic costs and benefits.
Right. Did you see my post in EV WhatsApp group about the Thiel argument here?
I have not checked. I just hate WhatsApp. Its functionality is so poor. If it were an EV signal group, I would check it. I check a bunch of signal groups. I check a bunch of Twitter groups. WhatsApp is just awful. So I haven't checked that group chat in forever.
Yeah,
I haven't checked that group chat until, like, basically since, like, basically the event ended.
Yeah, so I post, like, I realized I reread Zero to Run, and there's a really cool chapter about AI, and where Theo is basically arguing that our intelligence is very different from these sort of large language model or AI intelligence, where we're a lot more creative, we have a lot more sort of agency, disobedience. And so we can use AI, we can see AI sort of as a competitor for our cognitive skills globally, but there's much more symbiosis than an actual displacement that could occur, because even the copywriters, the 10x copywriters are, like, augmented by ChatGPT, or the software engineers, they collaborate with AI rather than competing with it. So even if we think there's, like, displacement happening, yeah, I think the basic assumption might be wrong, that rather than displacement, what's going to happen is that there's more collaboration and people just save time on these minutiae tasks.
On net, I believe that, right? I still think that's going to be the positive outcome in most areas, right? It's really, like, I should add, like, an addendum to, like, the thing that I said previously, is that, like, I think it's only really affecting, like, very specific areas. I think, like,
for example,
yeah, art will get a lot worse because, you know, like, the actual quality of art, or, like, not even, like, art as in, like, what exists, right? I think in terms of what exists, art will be much better. But in terms of, like, the economics of art, you won't succeed in art by doing good work anymore, because good work is produced at kind of, like, very low marginal value. But, like, you'll get a lot of, you'll succeed in, like, quote-unquote art by, like, basically being very good at like getting the government sinecures that existed in a world and will continue to exist because the people who set them up didn't realize that the marginal cost of good art will be very low.
Said government sinecures?
Like, that's what I mean, where you're going to get, like, entire basically fake sectors. I think, like, art, like, visual art is going to be by far the biggest example of this. Where, like, there will really be no reason to be doing, like, non-AI assisted art. But it will be subsidized because of political economy, because people who have connection, like, the existing art economy and funding structure is already based on achieving those sinecures. So the people who are good at achieving those sinecures will be also be very good at basically convincing those people not to allow AI art, even though AI art is strictly superior than the stuff that they're rewarding it to. And you know, if you wanted to make AI art indistinguishable from that, you could. So yeah, that's just going to become much more fake, much more based on kind of a system of insider connections and socialization, and even less tied to, you know, any kind of value or difficulty or ability, if it was already, to the extent that it was even tied to those things in the first place.
Hmm. Let's talk about the AI industry, the market dynamics, and yeah, the future of big AI companies. I saw you reposted or you shared the article on the Google Moats leak, quote unquote, document. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that?
Right. So I should be clear, you know, it's a very interesting document. I do not necessarily agree with the commentary on the document. I think like I talk about this with Bern Hobart for my podcast that will be out on Monday, May 15th. And this is one of the topics we talk about, the difference between qualitative and quantitative moats. So, you know, like there can be like this theoretical idea, oh, each of the developments are not, you know, are very easy to catch up on individually. Everyone can run these experiments. It does not, there's no kind of strict asymmetric advantage. However, when you have basically the best team of researchers and you have not just 10 of these things, but you have, you know, thousands, if not millions, of these small optimizations, then catching up from an open source community or from any kind of competitor is still going to be difficult, right? Just because you can replicate any one of these things at rather low cost doesn't mean that you can replicate all of them at the same low cost. In fact, I think that to replicate all of them would require much greater cost, and that's the main problem that you have. I think that the kind of like commentary on that underrates the ability for existing AI companies to compete and to maintain an advantage.
So, because Google has all these existing infrastructures, engineers, they shouldn't worry too much about their moat because they can, in fact, just spin up new AI products, companies.
Pretty much.
Hmm. Yeah. I found this point curious about the large language model sort of being in like, leaked into the open source. And then this guy saying in the article that the inventions can be like integrated back into the model and then Facebook can build on top of it.
I'm not sure how much that's going to be an actual factor. Like, I'm not sure how much Facebook is going to like take the existing level of open source development and just kind of like copy paste it back into their own tools. To the extent that they do that, I'm not sure if it'll be all that much better than kind of just spending, you know, there's two possibilities for this. One is the thing that I just described, and the second is the more realistic thing, which is that like the open source group kind of publishes a development. So a team in Microsoft is just, or like Facebook or whatever, is just like, okay, I think we can replicate this. They replicate it and they build on top of their own model, as opposed to this like weird, like convoluted version where they put out the entire model, the open source community does some changes on the entire model, and they kind of like just like copy paste all of the changes at once. I think that this kind of like, this second model is just less likely. It's very different than basically how almost all of software development has happened, right? Like, this isn't to say that like the open source community isn't useful and won't make useful discoveries, right? It's just that the process of kind of learning from them will just proceed in the same way that it has in the past.
Right. Yeah, I think the invention goes in both directions. So the open source people might copy stuff from if a company releases new research, and then the other way around. So I don't see how like owning the initial version of the model is like so beneficial. But and then, so the qualitative modes, is that how does that differ? Is that sort of the how would you
When I say like quantitative versus qualitative modes, I basically use like qualitative modes as in like there is this like clear thing that one group can do that the other group cannot, right? Something like, oh, we have an AI model at all versus, you know, not having an AI model at all. And I just use that as like a contrasting thing for the type of advantages that they have now, right? Like none of the advantages are kind of like black or white. All of them are kind of minor speed ups in efficiency or accuracy. The point is that like they don't need to be qualitative, right? They can just have a very large number of quantitative advantages.
Right, right. And then, I also went through some of your previous articles, sort of gaining inspiration for this in chat, and skimmed your article in Midwits. I didn't fully understand sort of the implication, especially for critical race theory, or what exactly you encapsulate under critical race theory. Would love to hear your explanation of Midwits. And
that article wasn't really about culture, or like it wasn't really about the culture war stuff. It was basically about organizational decline, right? And it was like organizational decline, and like if there is any relation to the culture war stuff, is that like culture war stuff is downstream of that. But the thesis is this, you know, like Steve Jobs is very well known for kind of talking about like the positive recruitment cycle, right? Where A player, his line is something like A players recruit A players, B players recruit B, C, and D players, right? There's this kind of idea that basically if you have people who are competitive, who are kind of truth oriented, then they'll create a community that is more and more like that, right? So that's like the positive version of that. And what I observed is that in many organizations, literally the opposite thing happens, right? You have some people who are like somewhat truth oriented, who are kind of mixed, right? But maybe this is kind of corollary to Steve Jobs' point, is that when you have those people in an environment where kind of the top, the most high quality of people are kind of pushed away for basically like competition reasons, right? Like if you are, take the US government, for example, you don't, many top software engineers I know, and I'm sure this is a very general trend, don't want to work at the US government because it's just much slower, it's more boring, you have to deal with more bureaucracy. And they have better things to be doing. They can make more money doing software engineering. And so you basically have a selection out of the top, right? And what is basically incentivized out of that is you have the thing that's incentivized is now conformity, right? That the thing that is selected for is not essentially like you can think of like some kind of filter that's being applied, right? If you're having a job interview, you're obviously filtering some like lower bound of people who are not making it, who just failed to pass the interview. But within your job offer, you're also filtering out like all these high end people because your job just sucks, right? So you have like two types of filters. You have the thing that's filtering from the top. You have the thing that's filtering from the bottom. So in practice, the thing that you get is just like a much higher increased rate of conformity. And the most important kind of feedback loop here is that when you get that higher rate of conformity, you further push out the smart people, right? You further push out people from the top. So essentially you have this cycle where increased conformity leads to loss of top talent, and loss of top talent leads to increased conformity. And I argue that this is one of, if not the primary sources of organizational decline.
Could you elaborate on the top down sort of filtering? I understand that sort of the A higher speed.
Right. The most easy way to think about it is that, you know, people have better things to do. If you are like, if you're an A player, if you're a top tier software engineer, or just very intelligent person, you have better things to do than put up with a lot of bureaucracy and conformity and status signaling. Like, that's just a waste of your time. It's a waste of your money. And you can get more money by going somewhere else, right? You can get more money by going to Silicon Valley, for example, by going to startups where both you might have more meritocracy and you just have much better of an environment.
Okay, so the broader point is like sort of politics is largely dominated already by midwits or sort of like B players, and thus you want to have like extremely intelligent, capable people going into it as well?
Yeah, yeah. More like C players. I'm sure some of them are good people, but right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. How could we change that?
Right. So one way that it's been done very successfully in the past is civil service reform. So essentially requiring like what are basically like IQ tests, competence tests, let's say, for government positions and really hiring based on that. That was a success story in Singapore, success story in China, and success story in like FDR's government, right? So in America a long time ago as well.
FDR is one of the presidents or?
Yeah, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Okay. He was the president during the Second World War, Great Depression. Yeah, very notable president.
Right. Interesting.
But yeah, like essentially you can do this. You can like marginally improve this problem by essentially introducing hard metrics of competence. The problem is that the obstacle to introducing those hard measures of competence are exactly the people who would be punished by it, right? Like the incompetent people are like not so incompetent that they won't realize that this will put them out of a job. So that's the major problem, right? The major problem is that like your internal political economy is changed by the exact things that make your kind of external economy or your external recruiting so difficult. It's like literally the same problem.
And then how did Singapore ended up doing it? It's just
Singapore's example was more of, you know, like basically they had to it was basically like the founding of a new state, right? It was they had less of this problem because there was just nothing there. They just had to build something competent, and at least relatively it has remained very competent. The government of Singapore, I mean. And so when I say like they did this before, I mean that they basically established a competent government. Not necessarily that they took, you know, an extremely incompetent government and reversed it. I don't think that's really comparable in this case. In terms of reversing an incompetent government, I would say the Chinese government is a better example of this. I'm sorry, what was the question?
So Chinese also did this and like made the reverse work?
Yeah, these were kind of like the Dengist reforms.
And then I'm curious about, I listened a bit to your Moments of Zen interview, and there the idea of the free market of ideas came up. And I think you're a bit critical that the market is like efficient. Could you elaborate on like the idea of the free market?
I've been giving this line for a while now is the free market selects against the free market. It's sort of related to the thing that we were talking about before, actually. You need smart people working in politics, because if all of the smart people go into industry, then like the people regulating that industry is all stupid. And that's a problem. Like, if I'm sure that like the marginal nuclear engineer in like the 1960s would have been better off going into politics, because your problem was that because of politics, essentially nuclear energy was banned, right? They established the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and then proceeded to not approve new nuclear power plants. Just like truly destructive, absolutely annihilated what could have been one of the most thriving new industries. And this was because we didn't have enough smart people in politics. And so, yeah, I think that the marginal, you know, the marginal kind of competent, highly motivated person should not be going into tech or startups at this point, should be definitely going into basically power wielding industries. So politics, media, NGOs, although you can argue that's very related to politics, not really academia in terms of pure research, but like academia in terms of areas that will influence politics, right? You like more power, like smart people just need to be much more power hungry. And they like there's this phrase by certain people who read my Substack called like, you need to know what time it is, right? And the idea of that is basically a sense of urgency, a sense of like strategy that basically if you do nothing, then many more of your freedoms will be lost. Many more of like the opportunities that you might think you have, whether that's AI, whether that's biotech, which has been smothered for more than a century now, whether it's genetic editing, right? All of these potentially life-saving, life-changing technologies will... It's not trivial that you're going to get them. It's not trivial that the optimism and the hope that you're promised will come to you. And if you want to do something that like actually matters to the world, you should be basically seeking power, or to remove, more importantly, to remove power from the hands of pretty much the worst people. Certainly incompetent. But I think like, take the FTC, for example. The more I've kind of read about the FTC, the more I think like these people are not like simply stupid, but they're also, you know, like genuinely evil, and their kind of value function, their kind of objective function is like almost exactly correlated with harm to normal people. In terms of just like the type of person that the FTC or these regulatory bodies attracts is the exact type of person who is like neurotic about progress and neurotic about new technologies. And that's exactly the thing the government has done the most in order to harm normal people.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting that people don't realize how much harm regulation creates, and the cost is unfortunately very hidden.
I don't even think that's true. I don't think it's all that hidden. I think like, like even among like normal Americans, they hate regulators. Maybe, you know, like they hate like, you know, like big pharma more for some reason, right? Like big pharma takes the blame. Maybe like they hate the regulated industries. Maybe they blame the companies for that. Actually, this is kind of something that's very remarkable, right? Is that like a lot of people will blame things that are like clearly caused by regulators on the companies that are being regulated, right? The best example of this is like that people will like blame developers for high housing prices. It's like this is just the opposite of the problem. This is literally the opposite of the problem. Or like they'll blame like this is something that's very funny as well, is that they'll blame Pfizer for like vaccine mandates. It's like
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
No, they're just look at the people who are enacting the mandates. Like, who are those people? You know, like it's just a different group of people. I agree with you. I think that in a lot of these cases, or like I agree with you that there's like a vast amount of harm that's being done. I somewhat agree with you that people basically like blame the wrong people, but. In my view, like a lot more of this is like a question of agency, right? It's a question of like who could realistically change something, who is like competent enough and skilled enough and passionate enough to like potentially change something. And to me, like that's like the marginal Silicon Valley founder, right? Like the marginal Silicon Valley founder should, you know, basically take a pay cut and identify who are the best people to be put in positions of power and put those positions or like and try their best to get those people in said positions of power.
Yeah, that seems like a high ask, because you're essentially asking people to be altruistic, and I think everyone
but people are altruistic, you know, like this whole like effective altruism thing, it's in the name, you know. It only exists because people are altruistic. People want to spend their time doing something worthwhile. I think that there's just this impression that the thing that you could do that's the most worthwhile is like start the marginal Silicon Valley company instead of like stopping the government from banning entire industries. You know, like part of this is because we've basically been on a trend of just like ever increasing L's, right? Like the FDA existing for this long and basically expanding its political entrenchment is like just a continuous sequence of L's, right? Every drug that the FDA bans, which is essentially all of them, right? All of them except for the ones that they write up an exception for, right? It's just an L, right? So we've been taking L's for more than a century. And because of that, it's kind of hard to imagine what it would be like to get a W, right? To just say like, you know, like if the Supreme Court today just ruled, like, oh, you know what? The FDA, in fact, cannot ban all drugs by default. That is not, in fact, a power that is given to the FDA. The amount of, like, that would create more technological progress, or that would be create, like, an equivalent amount of technological progress to, essentially, I would say, like, arguably more than, like, the past 10 years of Silicon Valley, right? Maybe save the AI stuff. We don't know how it pans out yet. So that's just a win at an enormous magnitude. So like, you do your cost-benefit calculation. It's like, what is the amount of political... What is the amount of effort that it would take to get this win? You know, what's the probability that I get this win? As opposed to, like, what's the amount of effort it would take to do a startup and for that startup to do... And, like, what is the expected amount of good for that startup to do? Yeah, I think that it's just very... For, like, the marginal person... Once again, it's just much better to kind of worry more about power than about making money.
Oh, interesting. Are you saying that even like sort of selfishly, if I'm a startup founder, I might gain more value for myself at the end and for society if I go into like regulatory industry and like, for example, remove these FDA regulations? Because that will like create 10 decades.
Well, yeah, in practice, right? In practice, like the drugs that you will get are kind of like substantively improving your quality of life, right? Whether it's longevity research, life extension, whether it's genetic, or like obviously, you know, like you're not going to, you could actually theoretically clone yourself. Actually, the technology kind of exists for that already. That might be a possibility if you would want to do that. But genetic editing for your descendants, for sure. All these things are like wildly positive for you as well, right? So like, I don't know, like if you're gonna be a VC or if you're gonna be like a Silicon Valley founder, I'm not gonna pretend that will not in the short term give you a lot more money, but in terms of like quality of life, I don't know, like it depends on the person, right? If you just want a lot of money, you're probably still better off going into Silicon Valley. If you want like a higher quality of life, yeah. I agree with you. Like it's actually much more of a jump ball. It might actually be the case that the higher quality of life thing is actually to help get the FDA abolished.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was my point, but that makes a bit of sense. I think I also agree with the point that like people like to be altruistic, where I think they like to signal that they want to be altruistic, and everyone, that's like a deeply psychological phenomenon, but I think nobody's actually truly altruistic, but everybody likes to be altruistic for the sake of making other people be altruistic, because that is sort of a loop where if I tell everyone, oh, let's be altruistic, then that has benefits for myself. At least that's what I read in this paper, which is quite interesting, which I might link here. So
yeah.
Selfishly speaking, I think if anyone's listening to this, please go into deregulate the FDA regulations. That would be great.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Also with the second point about altruism being sort of a selfish cause, the deep root cause being selfish.
I don't know. Like, I think intentions are notoriously hard to measure. I think in general, you should assume that people are kind of less rationalistic and more kind of like biologically motivated. I think that matches with empirics. There's kind of like the argument of Robin Hanson's book, The Elephant in the Brain. Yeah, there's like a naive version of this where it's like, oh, people are only altruistic because they're kind of like they're trying to get status and they're trying to get things for themselves. Like the conscious version of that is kind of overrated, I think, and is kind of a narrative that you can't really prove either way. What can be proven is basically like biological correlates of this, which is basically something like, oh yeah, a lot of instincts evolved and continue to persist in populations because they are kind of like status seeking, right? So the idea is not that, you know, like your average person has a kind of master plan of like, I'm going to go and I'm going to lie to all of these people and I'm going to get all the status for myself. Like, that's not very realistic. Instead, it's something like, say, like envy, right? Envy exists because it is a way to, historically at least, accumulate resources, right? Evolutionarily, to accumulate resources. And so people feel envious. They lash out in envious ways. They target people. And maybe they're not consciously thinking that, oh, this is going to get me status, but that's like the consequence, right? I think this is true in a lot of these cases where like people have like a conspiratorial version of this argument where it just involves like so much more planning than is actually necessary for something like the same outcome to come about. Maybe this is something that I'll drop on your podcast instead of like in my own writing or something. But like, I think a lot of conspiracy theories are like basically okay for this reason. Like, they're wrong and they're stupid, but you should kind of like treat. Yeah, there's like this hypothetical article that I've been thinking about doing, which is something like people don't take the consequences of kind of evolutionary pressures towards egalitarianism seriously. Like, this is a pretty widely well-known or like widely agreed upon result. It was covered in this book called Hierarchy in the Forest by Christopher Boehm, that basically like egalitarian norms evolved because of mass murder, right? That like if you had someone who was basically known to be inferior and like publicly known to be inferior, then they would just like kill people in their sleep. And that like egalitarianism was kind of evolved as a way to defend against this. Don't take the consequences of that seriously enough, right? Like if hypothetically, you know, there was, you had breaking news, a bunch of mobsters in the 1900s took control of the government and like genetically engineered everyone to be egalitarianism in order to like protect their like crime racket, right? People would take that very seriously. You know, if that was like a true conspiracy theory, people would take that very seriously. The evolutionary equivalent of that, of like why people are egalitarianism, is like basically the same in terms of like consequence, right? But it's obviously not intentional, right? Obviously happened because of like evolutionary dynamics across like more than millennia, right? Across evolutionary time. And so there was no kind of like central coordination for this, right? Like the mafia analogy is just that. It's just an analogy. But the outcome is the same. And people take it significantly less seriously just because it's not any kind of like concerted effort, right? There's no like concentrated group of people who are like, oh, there's no smoke-filled back room, right? There's no concentrated group of people who are like, oh, this is our plan. It just ended up like this.
What about and, you know, Christianity? Like,
if you thought that this is pre-Christian, like I'm very skeptical of the kind of Nietzschean idea that this is just because of Christianity. Those instincts evolved in humanity far longer ago. You know, like maybe Christianity is just like the most efficient like public expression of that, but that's not the problem, right? Like if you kind of deleted Christianity from history, like it would still exist. It exists in many other countries. It exists in like, you know, every third world tribe. Right, these kind of egalitarian, like the argument equivalent to that, this is maybe a little bit of a straw man, but I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration, is like, oh, if we didn't have Christianity, we wouldn't have envy. And it's like, this is just false. This is just extremely false.
Yeah, I think there's, I don't know if you've read David Deutsch, where he talks about like culture memes and biological memes, and they both sort of interact with each other. So it's it's always hard to say which one is a culture meme and which one is like a biological instinct, which is like one we are born with. Where when you look at babies, they're extremely aggressive and they have like this they're like a rough diamond basically, where they're very, I think, non-egalitarian. But then they get sort of cultivated into this egalitarian being because we have these memes that they interact with. I think that might be another side of the coin, but you're arguing that it's a biological, like built-in instinct to be less aggressive, do less murders, and be egalitarian.
No. Not to do less murders. Okay. To do murders in an egalitarian direction. To kill people who are better than you instead of worse than you.
Whoa. how is that currently expressing itself? Like, do we see this happening? Or?
Oh, the expression of that is like egalitarian social norms, right? So the argument is something like this. In the past, people would kill those who were basically going to evolutionarily outcompete them. You can say like, okay, this is the state of nature, it's fine. But the thing that evolved around that is a sense of egalitarianism where you'll like lie to people. And let me just look up this quote from Christopher Boehm. So Christopher Boehm's book, Hierarchy in the Forest. I can't find it. I can find the book, but I can't find the quote right now. But it's something like, he just like describes in one of his passages about hunter-gatherers. And like one of the social patterns that would happen as a result of this is like one or two hunter-gatherers would kill an animal and would basically like feed the entire tribe. And like all the other men in the tribe would basically start like making fun of the people, not like the least productive, but the most productive people. And this is just like, you know, it's just repulsive. It's just awful.
Why would they do that?
It's just like,
isn't this like
because it's evolutionarily adaptive, right? Because this is the mechanism for essentially like placating, you know, like the inferior people.
Oh, I thought they're making fun of the person who killed the animal. Or who's making
Exactly, right? So the point is that like people who do successful things increase in status because, well, they did good things, right? And it's not just like they're keeping all the meat for themselves. They gave everyone the meat. But in order to kind of reduce their status and to compete for mates and compete for resources, everyone else like gangs up on the most successful people.
Gangs up
like that's the social equilibria, right? Okay. Yeah. So like the shift, I maybe like compressed this too much. I thought that you had to go at three, but like the slower version of this is just like the physical leads to the social, right? That essentially the kind of first order version of this is like, okay, so there's a very successful, you know, like alpha male gets all of the mates, and then like the person who would be otherwise outcompeted like kills this person in their sleep, right? That's like the first order version of this. And obviously this can be very consequential in multiple ways. One is that, you know, if you're a murderer, other people might want to kill you. And the other is that if you kill the most successful person, then your chance of getting meat just significantly dropped. Chance of survival in general, right, as a group. You can't just keep, if you keep killing the most successful people, eventually all of the successful people will be gone. And then the second order effect of this is essentially the social norms that adapt around this, right? So one is like the social norm of people wanting to essentially reduce the best people's status through ways other than murder. And so that's on one side. And the version of this, like, how do you expect like the better people to adapt? The actual, like, in practice way that they adapted is basically to like go along with this, is to give egalitarian status signals to kind of promote those quote unquote at the bottom, right? And you can see this very, very well reflected in contemporary politics. So like we kind of understood through like reason and technology that like the first order layer is bad, right? We should not be just murdering people, especially we should definitely not be murdering people who are successful and are the only reason your tribe got to eat tonight. We figured out that is evil and almost like definitionally evil, basically from the start of civilization. And we have not, like, very few people have caught up to that second layer, right? Very few people have like caught up to the fact that, like, you know, this thing that is directly caused by what we consider to be, you know, basically the most evil category of person, you know, maybe that is also bad, right? Evolutionary time is very slow. People have really, if you think about it, it's kind of like a miracle that rule of law exists in the first place, right? So I'm not like too pessimistic on the fact that we haven't, as like that societies haven't adapted to like the second order problem either. I'm kind of just more surprised that society adapted to the first order problem. But yeah, like I think like this as a kind of like founding narrative for a lot of the political problems, especially like the sorting problems that we were talking about earlier, the fact that politics often attracts basically like incompetent people. I think like this is a very people like very much underrate like the significance, even like people who believe in like the truthfulness of that narrative, right? Like I know a lot of people who believe like the truthfulness of that narrative, right? Of egalitarianism as a kind of like evolved appeasement for murderers. I know a lot of people who believe that and just don't take it seriously enough.
Yeah, I think that matches quite well. So just to confirm, you're saying the second point of like promoting the bottom is sort of the same effect as like wokeism, or it is like virtue signaling?
Yeah, wokeism is kind of like the wrong... wokeism is kind of like a temporary problem, and this is like a literally like since the dawn of the human species problem. But yeah, you can see that as a kind of downstream, right? Like the more general, you know, like the more general, I would say like egalitarianism is a better label on it than wokeism. It's not perfect,
right?
But yeah, like wokeness is this is kind like of like a blind version,
and maybe an extreme. Yeah.
Sorry,
maybe it's more like an extreme or sort of a outgrowth.
No, if anything, it's kind of like less extreme, right? Like the more extreme version is like socialism. Yeah, wokeism is honestly like a relatively small manifestation of this problem. Like I say relative because I think people really don't take it seriously enough, right? They don't take like the problem of egalitarianism seriously enough. But like, yeah, for like, I think that if you like solve wokeism, if like you waved a magic wand and like all of wokeism just disappeared and people stopped applying this along the racial dimension, right? People like went back to applying it on like the class dimension, right? That would arguably be worse, depending on how extreme the class version of it is. So yeah, I don't see wokeism as like a particularly bad version of this. It's still bad, but like it's a drop in the bucket.
So one thing that I was kind of confused by is your point on polarization and obstructionism, where you treated some people just like democracy because it promotes polarization and obstructionism. The only thing good about it is the polarization, the only thing good about it is the polarization and obstructionism. Could you explain that one?
That is maybe, you know, it's Twitter. It's like a little bit more, it's like 10% more extreme than I actually think. But yeah, I think that obstructionism is a huge positive because...
Wait, so what is obstructionism?
It's basically when the main goal of a political party out of power is to stop the other party from doing things. So like the Democrats are in power right now. Joe Biden right now is actually a great example of this. Joe Biden is the president. The Democrats have the Senate. The Republicans have the House. So what are the Republicans going to use the House for? To absolutely stop anything that the Democrats are doing. And, you know, if you just basically have libertarian fundamentals of it's better on average if the government does not interfere with things, then this is obviously a huge benefit because they're interfering with fewer things. Yeah, and it's more of an address to like this point that Ezra Klein makes and that other people like Jonathan Haidt make, people who are essentially like worried about polarization, right? They're worried, like this is Ezra Klein says this like specifically in his book. He says something like polarization is increasing. People kind of hate the other side just for being the other side, right? Republicans hate Democrats. Democrats hate Republicans. And they just have an attitude towards them where senators are just punished for working with the other side, right? Like if you are, you know, Joe Manchin and you're working with Republicans, then the Democrats think that you're evil. If you're like Mitt Romney and you're working with Democrats, and Republicans think you're evil. And Ezra Klein says, he has these empirical studies, which I basically agree with. He says that like this makes it so that much fewer important bills are passed. People don't compromise. They just don't do anything, right? And he thinks this is bad. And I basically agree with him on the empirics. I agree with him basically on the fact that that polarization causes people to do fewer things, and I just think that that's good.
Isn't that sort of counteracting your previous point that regulation is mostly bad and that we'll end up regulating more things to that? Or is the point that because we don't agree
Is that like government doesn't do anything, right? These are like this is the government, right? It's not that like Democrats hate Republicans and then like they work together to like ban nuclear energy, right? Like no. Like the probability that they ban nuclear energy is reduced because Democrats hate Republicans and they just can't get the vote through, right? Like this is actually like very practical when it comes to AI policy right now. One of the reasons why I'm not really focused on legislation is that like they have the released version of the legislation, right, that Senator Schumer wanted to push. And, like, there's no way this passes the Republican House, right? There's no way this gets enough of Republican votes. And so we can basically be assured that that's not going to be the main avenue of threat. Like this is a huge benefit to decreasing regulation.
Makes sense. Yeah, I think Karl Popper also talked about this as dogma, where you, or Mark Andreessen said, like, opinions... strong opinions loosely held, or maybe it was the other way around, that you have like, yeah, you really pursue a opinion to the fullest rather than compromising and like mix mashing your opinions into something weaker and less true.
Yeah, in terms of like, yeah, there's usually two ways that people study this, two or three. There's issue polarization, and then there's affective polarization, and then sometimes partisanship. Although I think the latter two are pretty close together. But issue polarization is just like what people actually think the government should do, or like what people think policies actually should be, right? And then affective polarization is just like how much do you hate the other side? And here I'm mostly talking about affective polarization, just like, you know, hating the other guys for the sake of hating the other guys. I think that's almost universally positive. Issue polarization, I'm more hesitant on. Just people who just like believe more extreme things, believe that like most of the time it's pretty hard for you to believe more extreme things without believing that the government should do more. There are exceptions to this, of course, but like, you know, I'm less happy to say that it's like universally positive for people to have more extreme beliefs. What I am mainly referring to when it comes to like especially polarization in the United States is that a lot of it is just tribalism, and I think like the blank tribalism is good.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay, then we chatted a bit about the education system, and then you mentioned that the attrition rate should be higher, and sort of a more aggressive case of the Freddie Dober case. Could you elaborate on that? Or who's Freddie Dober?
Freddie Dober wrote this book, I think, The Cult of Smart, where he talks about this. He talks about how, yeah, a lot of the narrative around education is either based on kind of just like poorly done science, just like unreplicable, or just like clearly methodologically flawed science, or based on nothing at all. He talks a bit about genetic factors in intelligence here and in academic performance. And he basically makes the case that like many people, or like I think like his specific policy suggestion is that like people are allowed to drop out much earlier. I don't remember if it was like middle school or at the start of high school, but basically like let more people drop out. Yeah, and I believe that, but like to a larger extent, and also that some people should be kind of like forced to drop out after some number of failures. I'm not too specific on the calibration. I'm not too well read on education policy, but like in terms of the direction, that's definitely the case.
Yeah. Just to like regulate the funding, or move the funding in the right direction, I guess, to the people who actually benefit from.
It's not even the funding. It's like signaling equilibria, right? Like if high schools pass 100% of people, then a high school degree is essentially meaningless. But if high schools pass, say, like 50% of people, right, then suddenly that is a valuable credential again. And you see this in history, right? You see this in history with credential inflation. Obviously, it went the other way, right, where high schools became significantly easier and then colleges replaced them and also started to become significantly easier, right? But, so you see this as a longitudinal effect in the other direction. And I think it's fair to assume, like, if we made high school harder again, then its credential as a value would go up again.
The question is if we want it to be a credential or if we just want it to serve as a function to educate people, right? If they want to be educated.
Right. There's no reason not to do, like, the idea is that, like, I mean, I'm kind of a believer that you can still have true signals, right? That, like, that you can somewhat align the two things. Like, the effect of making high school harder would not just be that you teach more people, right? It would be the, it would be that the credential is kind of more true, right? It would be more accurate. Yeah. So like, these two things are not a trade-off, right? It's not like you make high school harder and you're, like, teaching people less, right? In fact, that would be pretty impossible. When you make high school harder, you're teaching people more, and you're making the credential more real.
Yeah, any final sort of messages to the listener, or, like, important shout-outs you want to give?
I don't know. Like, subscribe to From the New World, cactus.substack.com, fromthenew.world, pluralism.ai. They all go to the same place, or they all go to different sections of the same place. One is the main newsletter, the second one is the podcast, the third one is the AI stuff, the AI section.
Yeah,
that's the main place to find me. In terms of, like, concluding messages, I think that, like, a lot, I've been thinking about this recently, about, like, what is, like, worth doing, what is, like, a worthwhile thing to be up to. Yeah, and I do want to emphasize, you know, like, the free market does not select for the free market.
That's a good final statement. Awesome, Brian. Yeah, that was a pleasure chatting, and thank you so much for your time. And that was
fun. All good. Yeah, it was great being on.
Cool.